Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. And thank you very much to the organizers for inviting me here. So I'm going to discuss a few problems and results in transport by random flows. So one can generally think of, in practical terms, a cloud of smoke in one end of the room, and you want to study the properties of how it gets transported and spread around. And for our purposes, the room is almost infinite. And the behavior of, say, smoke particles is due to two phenomena. The molecular diffusion, which is due to small particles of air hitting the particles of dust, or particles of smoke. And as well, there are some microcurrents in the air which transport the same particles as well. So generally, we'll have a superposition of those two things. So for now, I'm just going to write very schematically the equation of motion, x dot of t, and later we'll distinguish between motion of one single particle, or we may look at the behavior of a whole set of continuum which is being transported by the flow. So for now, say if it's one particle, there's some velocity field, and I'll put a subscript omega to indicate that it's random, and it may depend on the position and time. And we'll assume for most part that the divergence is zero, and on average, so this expectation with respect to some type of randomness is zero also. So there's no average drift. And here, the right-hand side, in different problems, may be just a random vector field, or it may contain stochastic differentials. So maybe as we'll see in some problems. So what kind of problems are going to be considered? So the first type of problems, which was addressed quite some time ago, is what is a typical motion of one particle? And typically one expects that if you consider motion of one particle and there is a certain degree of randomness on the right-hand side, the long-term behavior will be similar to that of just Brownian motion, even though it may be not merely dw in the right-hand side. And the intuitive approach is as follows. You fix the initial position of that one particle at time zero, and look where it goes, where it is at time t, and then where it ends up at time 2t, etc. And if this capital T is sufficiently large, what happens to the particle at those non-intersecting time intervals is reasonably independent. So one assumes that the usual CLT should hold. In other words, xt over square root of t should converge as t goes to infinity to some normal random variable. Or if you scale the process down appropriately, it will converge to the diffusion process with constant coefficients. So it may be not that simple to practically prove such a statement, though. In particular, if the random field is not divergence-free, the particle can get trapped in certain areas, and the result actually may be not even true. So the precise type of results, maybe let me write down a couple of different versions. So there's been a lot of work done by starting with Kozlov, Vorodan, Papanikolaou, Fanzhang, in the case when, rather than writing the schematic equation on the top, I'll just put precisely dxt is equal to say dwt, so plus v of x t dt. So this is a random vector field with a certain diffusion process, which is non-degenerate. So, and note that the vector field here is time independent. So this is this is a basic homogenization result, and it's long has been known in case of V being periodic, and in case of V being random and certain ergodicity in space holding for V. This is under various assumptions on the distributions of V. This has been proven in a variety of papers by these people. Another problem is time-dependent vector field, and intuitively it should be easier if you allow the vector field to depend on time, because it seems that it should allow a greater degree of mixing, and those increments x t minus x zero, x 2t minus xt should have even more of a reason to be independent. Yet this problem with time-dependent vector field proved out somewhat more complicated, and here the results, I guess the first results are due to Fan Zhang, Komarovsky, Papanikolaou again. We showed similar results, that is xt over square root of t. So result exhibiting this diffusive behavior. So time dependent vector fields. Random vector fields. Plus diffusion, which is non-degenerate. Now, I'm going to state one of. My result is quite old, where we prove a similar type of statement without the requirement that there is some underlying diffusion process. So all the randomness is concentrated in the velocity field. So what we have is, theorem one. So you have this process dxt is equal to v of xt t dt, and v is Gaussian, Markovian in time, vector field. Then you have diffusive behavior. Long-time behavior. And similar results have been obtained at about the same time by again, this group of Fan Zhang, Komarovsky, and Papanikolaou. And what I want to stress is the method by which such type of result can be shown. Because this method can be, again, replicated in some more, potentially more complicated problems, more than just one-point motion. Namely, what do we have when we look at this equation? Well, there is some randomness on the right-hand side, yet it's not an ordinary diffusion process, because it does not have there's no finite dimensional space in which this equation can be considered. The trick, however, is to somehow turn this or approximate this with a finite dimensional stochastic differential equation. Namely, what one can do in the Gaussian Markovian case is to discretize the spectrum of that random velocity field. And then it turns out that basically one takes the Fourier transform of the spectral measure, the Fourier transform of the correlation function to get the spectrum, the spectral measure, and then forcefully concentrate it on a discrete set of points. Basically, you have instead of the measure, you integrate it over small squares and place all the measure in the center each time. And then one gets a finite dimensional system which looks like this. Dxt is equal to sum vi and of xt yit dt. Dyit is equal to ci dw ti minus yit dt. So what we have here is a coupled is a finite dimensional system, which is sort of a process on R2 cross Tn, and n is the number of points. Sorry, T2 cross Rn. N is the number of points in the discretization of the spectral measure, and these are Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes, independent Ornstein-Uhlenbeck processes, and they're coupled with a transport via this system. So VIs are certain just deterministic vector fields, and there's a certain process. It's not quite elliptic. The generator of this process is not quite elliptic. It's hyperelliptic. It has a hyperelliptic generator on this space, but basically this is an ordinary stochastic differential equation. And as you increase the number of modes, it will approximate the original equation, and you can show that whatever asymptotic results you can get for this finite dimensional equation, as n tends to infinity, you can carry them over to the original full-blown transport equation. We assume incompressibility, yeah. So the reason why I bring it up, because later on we'll formulate some problems which will be basically problems in ordinary stochastic differential equations. So the driving the underlying process will be finite dimensional, but you can see that finite dimensional processes become useful in describing physically meaningful equations of transport. The asymptotic properties of such an equation are studied via studying the generator of this process, which is a certain hyperelliptic operator, and for which some theory akin to elliptic theory needs to be developed, because of uniqueness and existence of solutions for the generator and such. So the next type of questions after studying the problem of one particle motion is, how do we study the evolution of sets carried by the flow? So normally the intuitive example is, say, you have an oil spill on the surface of the ocean. And how does it spread? So it may be quite different from looking at just one particle. In particular, we'll see that one particle, well, a typical displacement is about square root of time. If you look at a whole set, well, again, if you there's a continuum of points, and the furthermost one may go quite a bit faster than just at the square root rate. And here, when I say our results, I mean the results that we obtained with Dima Dolgopyat, Vadim Kaloshin, and myself. And also I'll bring up the results by I'll quote some results by Mike Cranston, Shevtsov, and Steinsaltz. In particular, the first results in the evolution, that's B, evolution of a set under flow. So you take some original set, whether it's a curve or a whole blob of stuff, and you get, well, if it is an incompressible flow, the error will be preserved. So maybe this is like a scaled-down version of what happens to it after a long time. So an example of non-trivial behavior linear growth of the diameter. And again, I yet didn't specify what kind of vector fields we consider. But on an intuitive level, how can we justify the linear growth of a connected set? So let's take an initial curve, and I do want it to be a connected curve. And let's wait till it hits a certain remote vertical line, say, if it is a planar motion. Now, if you take one point and wait, how long does it take for one point under the action of Brownian motion to go to a certain vertical line? It takes, well, it will almost certainly get there, but the average time is infinite. So the expected time for a Brownian particle to reach a certain level is infinite. Now, even if you take two particles moving independently, it's still infinite. Now, if you take three particles moving independently, already the first one of them, it's a simple calculation, the first one of them will reach a certain level in a time which has finite expectation. So let's call it tau 1, the time. By that time, this segment may have taken this shape. And again, there are, of course, a lot of simplifications in this intuitive explanation, because why should they move completely independently, etc.? But if you take three particles, 1, 2, 3, the first of them, maybe 3, will reach that line. Now we can consider another line separated by, say, unit distance, and wait till time tau 2. And again, what we want is that those the segment, when it comes to this vertical line, is not too short, so we can select again three points which are separated enough so their motion is almost independent. Tau 3, etc. And all the expectations of those tau 1, tau 2, tau 3, etc. are finite and bounded from uniformly bounded from above. So you can see that this whole thing moves in a certain direction with a positive speed. Well, this intuitive explanation, the rigorous results were first obtained by, as I said, Cranston, Shevtsov, Steinsaltz. And they did it now I'm going to bring up the examples of vector fields. So at first they did it for Brownian flows. Examples of flows. So the Brownian flows. Which is basically, you have a vector field, V of xt, and it's a Gaussian vector field, and you specify its correlation functions, which describe the vector field. So vfx1, t1, x2, t2. So the expectation is a certain function of the distance in space times delta function of the difference in time. So the motion of one single particle in this Brownian flow is just Brownian motion, but the multi-particle motion is already non-trivial. So, another example is those Gaussian Markov and time flows. And those are the ones I brought up earlier. And in particular, the results of Krasin, Shostov, and Steinsaltz showed the linear motion, and there are estimates from both above and below. So it doesn't move slower than linear, neither it moves faster than linear, even if you consider the continuum of... So, I mean, the estimates from above work for a continuum of points. So they've shown this for Gaussian Markov and time flows with finite number of Fourier modes. Now let me state the results that we proved with Dolgopyat and Kaloshin. So what we did, and for now we'll consider again a finite sort of a finite dimensional picture, which is dxt. So the motion is as follows. So you have vector fields xk, xt, stochastic differential. So this is Brownian motions. So a finite number of Brownian motions, maybe plus a certain vector field. And we'll make the whole picture periodic. Xk periodic. Well, as I said, those finite dimensional pictures have a lot in common with a full-blown physically relevant model. And we'll have certain non-degeneracy assumptions. Non-degeneracy assumption, I'll leave this blank for now. I'll just state the results, and then I'll go back to where the assumptions are. Theorem 1, call it center limit theorem for multi-point motion. Now, if you look at a bunch of points, even though what is written there is an ordinary stochastic differential equation, say on a torus, you can look at the coefficients are periodic. So the one-point motion is a very simple result on homogenization. So now when you consider even two points, and basically the phase space has twice the dimension, there are complications, because as soon as the points get close by, the motion becomes degenerate. They tend to maybe follow each other or stick, who knows. So... And one of the assumptions will be, of course, that the Lyapunov exponent is positive, so which forces them to get separated in a certain way. So the CLT for multipoint motion basically states that if we consider several points and look at the joint motion, scale it appropriately, it goes to Gaussian vector. So this is just a problem of overcoming this issue of degeneracy on the diagonal. Second result, I'll call it CLT for measures. Is less trivial, basically states the following. You start with a certain original set, and this set can, you can say it has uniform Lebesgue measure or any other measure, it doesn't matter much as long as the set has a positive Hausdorff dimension and the measure is appropriate according to it. So mu is measure on omega such that mu of x d mu of y over x minus y to the p is less than infinity. So basically, it's a set of positive Hausdorff dimension. And then you look at the image of that set. I'll call it omega t, and this is going to be omega 0 after time t. So you look at the, you take a push forward of the measure. So you look at the image of the measure under the flow. Mu t of A is defined as mu of those points, x0, such that xt belongs to the square root of Ta. So not only I'm looking at the push forward, but I'm also scaling it down back by a factor of square root of T. Now the central limit theorem states that this image of the measure, when scaled down properly, converges to a Gaussian measure. So the statement that mu t converges to normal random variable. For almost every realization of the flow. Now it's a very different statement from the ordinary central limit theorem, because this holds this version holds not with respect to the randomness, not with respect to the underlying randomness. Quite on the contrary, it works almost surely. But the central limit theorem is with respect to the measure concentrated on the initial set. It's a different CLT than what you get as a result of homogenization. Now, the next result, first time. So I guess I'll just state the results without having so just state the results without having much to say, without having time to say anything about the proofs. So we call it the limit shape theorem. Limit shape theorem. And again, we have an original set, and now it's going to be only two-dimensional. So I have omega zero. And let's look at the set of points which have been covered by the evolution of the set at any given moment of time, up to time t. So say it's an oil spill which goes about the ocean and kills all the fish under where it passes. And then maybe it moves forward, but the fish doesn't return there anymore. So let's see what kind of points get, what kind of set gets spoiled by the motion of this the soil spot. So we'll say that definition x belongs to the WT if x belongs to omega s for some s less or equal than t. And then theorem statement is that there exists a convex set which is not random. Which describes the shape of this spoiled area. Namely, T times B times 1 minus epsilon is contained in the spoiled set and in turn is contained in B 1 plus epsilon. So with a linear speed, it spreads, and if you take it just a little bit smaller or a little bit larger, the set WT is contained in between. It leaves no holes, therefore. Yes.
This is dimension two.
So non-degeneracy assumptions, I've skipped that. Well, maybe I'll not even write it, are as follows, that you want, if you just allow, say, one Brownian motion, one dimension, in one direction, to carry things around, then, of course, it will not go in the other direction, and that's going to be bad. So you want, for those vector fields, to satisfy the strong Hermander condition, or rather, in other words, it's got to be hyperelliptic motion. So, and as well, you want the same for the multipoint motion, say other than the diagonal, and the same for if you look at the induced motion and the tangent and the unit tangent bundle, so that guarantees the existence of non-random Lyapunov exponents, and you want the top Lyapunov exponent to be positive. Actually, this positivity of Lyapunov exponent allows us to use certain results by Strook and Baxendale to justify the very first theorem. That which is that two nearby points get far apart and the time it takes them to get far apart has exponential moments. That's basically Strook and Baxendale. Maybe the last thing I should also say, there's a theorem, theorem four or five, whatever it is, that the set of points which exhibit this linear speed of escape, well, it has measure zero, of course, because of the very first theorem, but it has full Hausdorff dimension. So, okay, so I guess I'm through. I'm out of time, right?
We have time for about 2 or 3 minutes of questions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the methods we are using are purely two-dimensional because, basically to show that we can reach a certain neighborhood of a faraway point, we use something like this intuitive argument where you reach successively the different levels. But then to show that the shape is independent of one of the points is to show that the shape is independent of what original curve you take or what original set you take, and basically whether you take say curve gamma 1 or curve gamma 2, want to show that it takes them about the same time to reach a faraway point. And the way it is done is this method is purely two-dimensional because what you do is you take several shifts of one of them, say gamma 2, because of periodicity, the motion is just going to be parallel. And then you show that there are stable manifolds connecting them. Almost surely there are certain curves whose length gets shrunk to zero with the evolution of the flow, and which can be passed through them like this. So, and this is a purely two-dimensional picture, because in three dimensions, even if you cannot surround one object with shifts of the other plus the stable manifolds, because it can always escape through yet another dimension. So that's gamma one. But now the evolution is clearly such that the shifts of gamma two move parallel to each other, and those stable manifolds connecting them get shrunk to zero, so they cannot be too far apart. But